First Committee on Rules. We have, we're going to hear an executive appointment by phone, but we have a number of members in the audience wishing to testify, Senate members, and tight schedules. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 933 and ask Senator Burdick, and would you like Mr. Schrader to come up with you? Okay, we're getting the head nod, so why don't you two come on up? And Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill that's before us?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 933 requires the filing of 10% of the total number of signatures required on a state initiative petition as a prerequisite for obtaining a ballot title from the Secretary of State. It also directs the Secretary of State to review proposed state initiative measures for compliance with constitutional procedural requirements.
Thank you.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 933 takes an important step in reducing the excessive cost and sometimes, in some cases, even abuse involved in the writing of ballot titles. What 933 would do is it would change the order in which petition signatures need to be gathered in order to get a measure on the ballot. It wouldn't add or subtract to the time required. It would just make more signatures required up front, so that only those measures that can show some demonstration of support would be able to go through the ballot title process, which is a fairly rigorous process where there's a draft ballot title that goes to the Attorney General, and then there's a chance to amend that. Then it potentially can go to the Supreme Court. Under the current system, the Department of Justice and the Oregon Supreme Court are required to commence the time-consuming and resource-intensive process of drafting ballot titles with the submission of any measure that is accompanied by only 25 signatures. And that's just, you can do that in an hour at a store. It just doesn't reflect serious support for a measure. I believe that Senate Bill 933 will cut down on the practice affectionately known as ballot title shopping by requiring a show of citizen support for a specific measure up front. In requiring approximately 10,000 signatures prior to initiating the ballot title drafting process, Senate Bill 933 will require the petitioner to demonstrate the kind of public support of a measure that will be necessary to get it passed once it gets on the ballot. Since the 10 to 15% upfront signatures count toward the total signatures required, this should not serve as a hindrance, but rather will become a benchmark in the demonstration of citizen support currently required by Oregon law. Senate Bill 933, despite some criticism, does not hurt the little guy, the person who has a good idea and wants to get it on the ballot. And I speak from experience on that because I did get a measure on the ballot. I presented only one measure. I went through the process. I got an initial ballot title that no one would ever shop for. It was the most dreadful draft ballot title, no offense, Mr. Schrader, that I have ever seen. But went through the process on it and got an acceptable ballot title by going through the process and not just going to submitting another measure. The measure I submitted was very well thought out. It eventually passed by 62% statewide. And so the process that that went into that definitely does work. I would be happy to answer any questions about Senate Bill 933, and I urge your support and appreciate the chance to talk to you about it. And Phil Schrader is here with any questions you might have.
Thank you. Mr. Schrader, do you wish to testify?
Senator Brown, thank you. I'd like to add just a couple of comments. I'm Philip Schrader, Special Counsel to the Attorney General, for the record. I was here before testifying before this committee on Senate Bill 201. That's the proposal that our office came forward with. We would be happy and more than happy to support Senator Burdick's proposal under Senate Bill 933. It effectuates many of the same kind of changes that our proposal does, and we support it wholeheartedly. It does not add any additional signature gathering, as Senator Burdick said, so there, it should not harm anybody from gathering the requisite signatures to qualify a measure for the ballot. It simply focuses the court's resources, our resources, the resources of the interested parties on measures that actually have a showing of support that, and a chance to get on the ballot. I urge your support of Senate Bill 933.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Ferriello.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. How many signatures is 10%?
Chair Brown, Senator Ferriello. It's a fluctuating number, but approximately, Senator Burdick answered it correctly, I think, with about 10,000 currently. It's generated by the requisite number of signatures to qualify for the ballot. If it's a proposed constitutional amendment, it is 6%, I believe, of the, or 8%, 8% of the voters who voted for the in the last gubernatorial election. If it's a statutory proposal, it's 6% of those signatures.
Senator Ferriello.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is a question for Senator Burdick, who I think is suggest is an expert in consultancy and campaigning. She's been very successful at that. How does the wording of a ballot title affect the prospects for passage?
It's the most important thing it's the most important thing to determine whether somebody's going to vote for a measure. Most pollsters, when they are doing polling on a ballot measure, actually present the language of the ballot title in their polling. It's the single most important item.
And this is a question for either of the panelists, Madam Chair, if I may.
Senator Ferriello.
Well, why is it necessary for people to shop for a ballot title?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferriello, it's not necessary. The process works. It works well. The process for getting a ballot title, and I'll say this instead of Mr. Schradl, since he actually works there, and I am a little more objective, I presume, but the process is the Attorney General, when the Secretary of State receives the initiative petition, they send it over to the Attorney General, and they issue a draft ballot title. And then there's a period for any interested party to comment on that draft ballot title and recommend changes or point out deficiencies in the title. And the title consists of the caption, which I believe is still 10 words, maybe 15 words now. And then it has a section on result of yes vote, result of no vote, and then it has a summary and background statement. So taken together, that ballot title is what voters look at, that because it actually does appear on the ballot.
I wouldn't dream of being argumentative, but I think there is definitely a need for people to do this process more than once. And it's because they feel that there's not honest brokerage of the ballot title drafting in the current process. And the point is,
Ferriello, that being the case, why should the public bear the cost of that? Why shouldn't the petitioners bear the cost then of the ballot title shopping as opposed to the public? I mean, no. That's sort of what I wrestle with, is that, you know, folks are doing this as a business. Taxpayers are subsidizing it. You know, we're on, obviously we have some fiscal constraints, as always. And, you know, why should the taxpayers subsidize folks that make their money off of this as a business?
No, Madam Chair, they shouldn't have to. The point is that if the process for drafting a ballot title were more open to influence and participation by the petitioners, they wouldn't have to make multiple requests to get the ballot title that they feel most adequately and accurately reflects what their ballot initiative does. Now, Madam Chairman, I see an issue here.
Okay.
But the issue that I see here has more to do with fair and honest brokerage of the ballot title than it does to raising the bar so that we make direct democracy far more difficult and expensive. And the bottom line here is that there is a need for people to do this ballot title shopping because they're not getting the product that they want in the first trip. Some people do. And Senator Burdick pointed out she did. And that my hat's off to her. She's here today to raise the bar for others that follow. I don't think that's necessarily
Madam Chair,
fair.
And Senator Ferriello, if I could correct that a little bit, I did not get the ballot title that I wanted. because the ballot title I wanted would have been much more positive toward the outcome I wanted in the election. I will have to say, however, that the ballot title I got was at least an accurate reflection of what the measure did. Mm-hmm. And in the initial one, it could have been about an invasion from Mars. I wish I would have brought it today to show you. But the system does work. But to say that the criterion should be a ballot title that is going to please the petitioner, that's not what the purpose of the ballot title is. The purpose of the ballot title is to give the voters an objective sense of what the measure does. And any petitioner, myself included, is not going to be happy with a lot of ballot titles because they would like them to sound a lot more positive.
Madam Chair, one last question.
Senator Farrioli.
So your initial ballot title was flawed.
It was very flawed, yes.
Well, what gives you any confidence that if somebody does hop over this higher bar and deliver 10,000 signatures, that their ballot title won't be just as badly flawed?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Farrioli, because that's how the process works. There is a process within the ballot title system for challenging a ballot title as being inadequate. And that process works because if the petitioner isn't happy with the final ballot title, they can still go to the Supreme Court and challenge it. And that if it doesn't reflect the measure, there's a process for doing that, and the process works.
Madam Chairman, I just see this as being an issue where a lot of folks who participate in the petition process and direct democracy see that flawed ballot titles routinely emerge from the Secretary of State's office. And I would assume that the reason they make more than one application is that sooner or later they have to get to the issue. And there is a ballot title eventually that emerges from that process that adequately reflects what people are trying to convey to the public. Making them go through the process of going to the Supreme Court on a one-time issue and making them get 10,000 signatures to even participate in the process seems to me to be abridgment. It seems to be a prior restraint issue. It's designed to make direct democracy difficult or impossible. Madam Chairman, I see no merit in that issue. What I do see merit in is that maybe streamlining the process for people to write their own ballot titles and submit those, or having a negotiation process between the Secretary of State's office and the ballot.
It's actually the Attorney General's office.
Attorney General's office and the ballot authors.
I'm sorry.
That would seem to be a lot more reasonable approach to solving the problem than to try to raise the bar for 10,000 signatures.
Great. Senator Farrioli, I've been more than happy. We heard this issue in February. It is now almost the end of March. It's April. I'm more than happy to entertain solutions to the problem that you see out there.
Madam Chair, making it easier rather than raising the bar.
Right. Bring us a solution. We're very happy to talk about it. Mr. Schradoff.
Chair Brown, yes, I'd like to make a couple of comments on that. You know, this discussion, I think this discussion needs to keep in mind that the ballot title serves a number of functions, primarily to inform the voting public about what the measure does, what the measure actually does. And I'd submit to you that some of the times when people are attempting to get different ballot titles, what they're really trying to get is a ballot title that doesn't accurately reflect what the measure does, and or then the policy that gets embodied into the proposed measure gets driven by a desire to get a glamorous or a more sellable ballot title as opposed to the policy that actually should be embodied in the measure itself. I do take issue with the fact that, you know, we're not perfect in drafting ballot titles, but we try and follow the statutory requirements to generate a fair and accurate and an impartial ballot title. Senator Burdick is absolutely correct. We don't satisfy all the public out there because the public has very different competing interests. The proponents of the measure would like to have one that would be a very sellable one. Opponents of the measure would like to have one that makes it look like the worst thing ever. Our job is to try and toe the line to give an accurate and impartial ballot title so that the voting public has the right information before it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrioli.
How would 10,000 signatures make that portion of the job fair and accurate easier or more efficacious?
Chair Brown, Senator Ferriero, the way it would is that right now, their last election cycle, there were 183 measures that got submitted. Seven of those went onto the ballot. You know, we expended, the court expended time and energy on dealing with 175 measures that did not get the requisite signatures to go on the ballot. This is simply an attempt to focus the resources on those that have reasonable support, so we aren't trying to say you have to get all of the signatures to get on the ballot, just those that have reasonable support to so that the resources can be devoted to those cases.
And Madam Chair, is it possible that at the end of the day you could submit the 10,000 signatures on a working ballot title and have one emerge from the system that's completely different than that working ballot title?
Chair Brown, Senator Ferriero, the proposal before you would have those first initial 10,000 signatures, approximately, get gathered with a copy of the proposed measure itself. It wouldn't have a generated description of it by our office. So that the conclusion of getting the 10,000 signatures, then that would generate the ballot title. So there'd only be one ballot title with respect to a proposed measure.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I understand that, but the point is that if folks are out there talking about the measure, and the ballot title is one, as Senator Byrd characterized earlier, that was terrible and didn't accurately reflect, in her opinion, the
there wouldn't be a ballot title.
There would be no ballot title.
It would just be the measure for the first 10,000 signatures.
Madam Chair, pardon me. I understand that.
Okay.
So folks go out with just the measure,
mm-hmm.
and they get 10,000 signatures. And then they get a ballot title that doesn't reflect, in their opinion, what their measure does.
That's not the statutory criteria. The statutory criteria is that it be fair and impartial, not whether or not it meets the petitioner's
fair and impartial are always in the mind of the beholder.
That's correct, but that's what the legislature has said the criteria for drafting the ballot title. If we want the ballot title to reflect the will of the petitioner, then the statutory language should reflect that.
Madam Chairman, that sounds like an excellent idea.
Senator Ferrioli, feel free to use a priority bill.
Senator Ferrioli, be careful what you wish for.
Right.
I think that goes all the way around.
Yes, it does. Senator Atkinson, do you have any questions before you?
Well, seeing both you and Senator Ferrioli sipping coffee to have this very spirited discussion while Senator Shields and I go particularly parched without caffeine, I think, is a good example of why we need coffee service.
Actually, Senator Atkinson,
but,
this
I
is Mexican hot chocolate, very minimal caffeine.
Share the wealth.
Okay, next time I go to Portland, I will. Anything else? Thank you both very much.
Good topic. Good.
Mr. Honeycutt, come on up.
Good conversation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
This is my, for the record, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. This is my one-session visit to the Senate Rules Committee.
Oh, we hope not.
Well,
I'm sure you'll be
I
there
actually
before
hope
session
so,
ends.
Madam Chair.
The Chair will not take that personally.
Absolutely not. It wasn't intended that way. I'm here to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 933, both for policy reasons, but also for legal reasons as well. There are a couple of things that Senator Burdick said that I agree with. The ballot title is crucial. I think that's, for any initiative proponent, I think that's absolutely true. And number two, the Attorney General is capable of drafting horrendous ballot titles. I've seen those on both sides of the issue, so I'm not sure it's always partisan, but it's certainly possible. What they didn't mention to you, however, is that the Supreme Court review of a ballot title is very deferential. An impartial ballot title, the Supreme Court's not going to draft a ballot title that they think better or more accurately describes the measure. As Senator Ferrioli said, impartiality is in the eyes of the beholder. I think that's accurate, and there are multiple ways to draft any ballot title that would survive the deferential review by the Supreme Court and yet not accurately characterize the measure. This really does impact the grassroots ability to put a measure on the ballot. We spent in 2003 if you averaged it out by the signature, now you can't pay by the signature at least now until ballot measure 26 is declared unconstitutional, which we think ultimately it will be. But at this point you can't pay by the signature. But if you average it out, we spent approximately $3 a signature to get ballot measure 37 on the ballot. To gather somewhere between 10 and 15,000 signatures is $30,000 to $45,000 just to get a ballot title, which everybody recognizes is the most crucial aspect of the measure. So you're asking groups to spend somewhere between $30,000 and $45,000 just for the privilege of at that point qualifying and or getting a ballot title on a measure. I'd say that's a little too much to ask people who want to exercise their rights to democracy. You asked why the public should bear those costs. I would ask the committee why the public should bear the cost of the thousands of bills that are introduced every session in this body that we all know aren't ever going to get a hearing or are going to move. And so, you know, that's a sort of a take a look in the mirror before you ask, you know, when you're asking those types of questions. I think that's just part of the democratic process. So we would oppose this bill. Now, from a legal perspective, I think this bill's got constitutional problems. There was the testimony from the Attorney General's office and Senator Burdick was that this measure didn't add any additional signature requirements. I don't read the bill that way. As I read the bill, you turn in between 10 and 15% of your signatures, and you can't turn in any more than 15%. With a constitutional amendment today, with about 100,000 signatures needed to qualify for the measure for the ballot, you're looking at turning in somewhere between 10 to 15,000 signatures. Now, at that point, the Secretary of State will or can, the measure says they don't have to, but the Secretary of State certainly can under the measure, do a validity check on those signatures, and if the validity check is less than 10%, then none of those signatures count under the terms of the measure. So if I turn in 15,000 signatures, because I certainly the bill prohibits me from turning in or gathering any more than that. If I turn in 15,000 and I somehow fall below a 66.6% validity rate, which certainly can happen, signatures on measure 37 we had a validity rate lower than 66.6%. So if I fall below that, let's say I turn in after the Secretary of State runs the review, I've got 9,900 valid signatures, then under the measure, none of those signatures count. Now, all of a sudden, I've got 9,900 valid signatures that don't count. I go out and I now have to gather 110,000 signatures to qualify for a measure for the ballot. That's not what the Constitution prescribes. And therefore, I think under this measure, if this measure sees the light of day and actually passes out of this body and gets signed by the governor, we'll challenge it on constitutional grounds. I think it's got a constitutional flaw. It's one that you could fix if you wanted to, but the bill as written, I think, violates Article 4, Section 1. So we would challenge it if it actually gets out of this body. This is bad policy. It was bad policy in 1999. It was bad policy in 2001. It was bad policy in 2003, 2005. It'll be bad policy next session. We would urge that this committee to follow this bill up and let it go.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Honeycutt? Thank you. Mr. Dan Meek, come on up. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Chair, Senators, my name is Dan Meek. I have represented in the past a variety of public interest groups, some of whom use the initiative process, particularly involving the radioactive waste, the Trojan nuclear power plant, and campaign finance reform. I believe that the system that would be established by Senate Bill 933 would make the initiative process unworkable for grassroots organizations, but it wouldn't impair the initiative process for organizations that go out and simply purchase their signatures by hiring professional signature gathering firms. It would be workable for them, but not for the grassroots, and I have quite a bit of personal experience with that, and I can tell you why. First of all, the bill would require that the initial signatures, the prospective petition basically, the number of signatures would increase from 25 to somewhere on the order, on the order of between, for a statutory measure, it would be between 8 and 12,000 for a constitutional amendment, between about 12 and 16,000, and those are the valid signatures, so you have to multiply that by about a factor of 1.4 or so in order to get the number of raw signatures that you need to collect. In any event, it's a much greater number than 25. Right now, it's practical to collect 25 because you simply use the prospective petition form, which doesn't say what the ballot measure is about, and you attach to it the full text of the measure. Now, some measures are necessarily more complicated than others, particularly in the area of taxes. Some even constitutional amendments that have been enacted in Oregon on tax limitation have been dozens of pages long, and some statutes are just inherently going to be more complicated than others. What this system does is it would require folks to go out and collect, upwards of 20,000 signatures for a measure with no ballot title on the signature sheet. The signature sheet essentially would just say, this is a signature sheet. Considering my experience with collecting signatures on measures, very few people would sign that because they're used to seeing the ballot title on the signature sheet. They wouldn't sign the blank signature sheet because they don't know what they're signing. Now, what this bill says...
Can I interrupt you there?
Yes.
I assume your concern is that folks like me, when I'm on the street, I'm not very interested in spending even 5 or 10 minutes to read the ballot measure itself. So that burden to get those 10,000 signatures or whatever it is would be high because folks are not going to read the ballot measure.
Well, Madam Chair, more than that, if I were out on the street right now, walking, not a shopping center because I can't be approached there, but on the actual street, and I were approached with someone with a petition to sign, a statewide measure petition, and it had no ballot title on it. It just said, here's a signature sheet, please sign this. I wouldn't sign it. Now, what the bill does to try to rectify that is it says that you have to staple an entire copy of the measure. So, for example, a campaign finance reform measure we just submitted is Petition 37, runs 20 single-space pages. So you'd have to staple 20 pages to every signature sheet. And if any of those pages came loose, and remember we're talking about volunteers here, these are not professional signature gatherers that you can enforce discipline upon. If any of the 20 pages comes loose from the signature sheet, that will invalidate all of the signatures. You know, what the Secretary of State does now on prospective petitions literally is counts the staple holes. If your text of the measure becomes loose, you can't staple it back on because they count the staple holes very carefully and they look to see if the staple hole is a little bigger than it looks like, the staple's a little loose. Well, that invalidates your sheet of signatures, and so that would create an enormous problem here.
Mr. Meek, Mr. Schreyer quoted, 158 ballot titles submitted last time around, and 7 were actually put on the ballot. Do you think we have an issue with ballot title shopping?
No, absolutely not. Ballot title shopping under the existing system cannot occur. In fact, the law requires that if you take a similar measure and submit it again, you have to get a similar ballot title. For example, for technical reasons, we have refiled the campaign finance reform ballot measure, statutory measure, a couple of times in this round for 2006, and we've gotten exactly the same ballot title word for word. Of course, if you submit different measures that do different things, you will get different ballot titles, but I don't consider that ballot title shopping. I consider that submitting a different measure and getting a different ballot title that accurately describes it. And if people are getting ballot titles that are somehow too favorable for their measures, then that's a problem with the way the Attorney General is drafting the ballot titles. To horrendously handicap grassroots organizations who are trying to get things on the ballot is not the solution for that. But let me give you the real logistical problem. I'm not even to the big problems yet. These are just small ones.
And just for the record, I think instead of 158, it was 183 ballot measures were submitted and only 7 got on the ballot. So I just want to clarify the numbers.
The other problem with this, from a volunteer organization point of view, is that when you have volunteers collecting signatures, you'll print up your signature sheets and your measure and send it out, distribute it statewide in a variety of methods, but typically by mail or by going to meetings in communities all over the state. And the volunteers will take the signature sheets, and in this case, each one would have to take a signature sheet stapled to whatever the measure happens to be. Under this system, somehow the ballot measure organizers are supposed to intuit and automatically know when there's 10 to 15% of the necessary signatures have been collected statewide. Well, when you have a system of volunteers who don't report to you, you can't force them to report back every day on how many signatures they have. It's not possible to know when there's 10 to 15%, except by contacting everyone and say, okay, stop collecting signatures, send it all in. Now, so then you know, that takes a while. Once again, these are not people who are being professionals about it. They're not being paid to do it. You have to depend upon their volunteer efforts. They send it in. What if you don't have the necessary number of signatures at that point? Well, then you have to contact your volunteers again and say, okay, start up again. And then maybe a few weeks later or months later, you call them in again. Eventually, let's say you finally get 10 to 15%, so you submit them to the Secretary of State. Then you have to tell all of your volunteers, stop collecting signatures for a period that ranges from a minimum of 7 weeks, if there's no ballot title challenge, to an average of 40 weeks if there is a ballot title challenge. Just stop. Now, if Grandma Millie down in Medford, who is collecting signatures from her friends as they come over to play bridge or whatever, has a signature sheet on her coffee table, her friends will probably continue to add their signatures to the sheet, but Grandma Millie won't know that those are now all invalid signatures because the initial turn-in has been done. Grandma Millie may well keep that signature sheet on her coffee table for months, and all of the signatures being collected will be invalid. Then what the organizers need to do is, once a ballot title is arrived at, really you have to wait for Supreme Court review if there's any ballot title challenge, because you don't want to have three different signature sheets on the streets, two of which are invalid at any particular time. So you wait to get your certified ballot title after the Supreme Court review. Then you have to send out signature sheets again to everyone and say, now these are the ones to start using these again. Well, these don't look like the other ones that we signed. Are we supposed to sign these again? Or did we already sign this, even though it looks different now? That's an element of confusion. And voters will be confused, signers will be confused, even volunteers will be confused. If someone does sign twice, the initial sheet and the other sheet, the current process is that if that duplicate is found in the verification process, then 400 signatures are subtracted from the number of valid signatures. That's why organizers ask people, please don't sign it twice, because it will just penalize us. In any event, if you look at a professional and paid signature gathering operation, no problem. Absolutely no problem with this. So what this does is that it severely penalizes volunteer organizations and has nothing to do with the kind of campaigns that do what? That are alleged to do ballot title shopping. It's not the volunteer organizations that submit 10 or 20 different versions of a measure in order to get a good title. It's the organizations that are then connected with the professional collection operations, typically, who go out and pay for this. So it is a solution. It's not a solution to the problem that's identified. I don't know that it's a solution to anything.
Did you testify last session on this bill?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't remember that, so.
Well, let me think. I may have only testified at the House.
Okay.
Last session. I may not have testified here.
Right.
In fact, I think that's the case.
Senator Farrielly has a question, and he needs to leave. So if you don't mind, if we would interrupt you so he could ask his question.
Mr. Meek, you mentioned three ballot initiatives that you've been involved with. Could you recap those just by issue and briefly?
Oh, there have been more than three, but the ones that I've been most involved in the actual signature gathering phase were measures in 1984 on radioactive waste disposal, 1986 on radioactive waste disposal, 1986, 1990, 1992 on the Trojan nuclear plant, and in 2002 on a campaign finance reform measure that barely did not qualify for the ballot.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrielly.
Were these all unpaid volunteers that you coordinated for?
Not all unpaid volunteers, except perhaps the radioactive waste disposal measure. Typically, the Trojan measures were very heavily volunteer with some paid collection at the end to make sure that we made the ballot. But I don't think, I'm not sure that any of them were pure volunteer. That's extremely difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. Chair, I appreciate it. I just was interested in the conclusions of the witness that this would make grassroots efforts at petitioning impossible.
I would say it would make it extremely difficult to succeed and make it much more difficult than the present system is, and I think it would cause Senator a tremendous amount of confusion unnecessarily among volunteers who are trying to petition their government for redress of grievances.
Thank you,
Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Farrelly. Do you have anything further, Mr. Meek?
The perceived problem is with the ballot title system. And if you take a look at the work that was done in the House of Representatives 2 years ago, there were a variety of proposals made on the bill that I think came from the Senate first. Among those were the strangest joint proposal you can imagine from Oregonians in Action and Common Cause. To change the way the ballot title process is done. What it would have done is, rather than have the Attorney General write the ballot titles and then make them subject to Supreme Court review, is to have a system where anyone within a period of time can offer or submit a ballot title, and the best one would be chosen in a baseball arbitration system by a group of retired judges. I think they were called Plan B judges, who I think are earning their pensions by performing additional service.
I think it's called light duty. Come back one month a year is basically what they do. So,
well, the system for baseball arbitration, allowing them to choose the best or the best title submitted, I think would eliminate a lot of the effort that goes in now to making arguments about ballot titles. What happens now is that the Attorney General comes out with a draft ballot title, and of course the people who like the measure make the arguments that they can that the ballot title could say something different that's more favorable. The opponents say things that make it less favorable. And no one really, none of the litigants or the interested parties really have an incentive to propose the most accurate and most informative ballot title. If you have a system of baseball arbitration, however, where the retired judges aren't going to devise their own ballot title, but are just going to select. And I think I've been cut off. No. Is going to select the best one that has been offered to them, then everyone has an incentive to offer the most accurate ballot title possible. And finally, I would say that another possible solution to the workload problem is simply to eliminate judicial review of the ballot titles that the Attorney General drafts. I don't think Oregonians in Action would be in favor of that. They, I think, have been far less satisfied with Attorney General ballot titles over the past several years than we have on our measures. But that's another situation. Not everything that goes in the voter's pamphlet or, for example, is subject to substantive judicial review. Financial impact statements are not. They were devised by the various government entities and are only subject to judicial review for procedural irregularity. So I would urge the committee not to accept Senate Bill 933 and instead to pursue other possible solutions to the perceived problem.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate you coming forward and testifying today on this bill.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 933? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing. The committee is officially in subcommittee. We would ask that Senator Ringo come join us as quickly as possible. Ms. Nielsen, would you give him a buzz? And I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on the candidacy. The candidacy of Yvonne Curtis for the Quality Education Commission, and we're going to give Ms. Curtis a call. And for folks in the audience, Senator Atkinson had to leave, and so we will not be moving forward on a hearing on Senate Bill 701 this morning. So we're going to try and work Senate Bill 858.
Curtis office, this is Debbie.
Hi, Debbie. This is Senator Brown. Is Ms. Curtis available?
She asked me to go get her out of her meeting when you called, so can you hold on just a moment and I will go do that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Now we can listen to elevator music. This is certainly the... Should I say it's the most elevating thing I've done this morning?
Oh, no.
No, I don't think I should say that.
No.
Well, I'd better enforce feeding of ducks. Which was the hearing
this morning?
At 7 o'clock in the morning.
Did that this morning? That's not okay.
I wanted to duck for cover. Could you suggest that?
We might go into recess here in a minute. I can't get a phone. Yeah, let's go on recess at this point. Mm-hmm. I'll leave on. It's beautiful, but we didn't think the whole meeting, the whole Capitol building needed to hear it. I've got a couple folks at the dais with me, Senator Frank Shields and the committee administrator, myself. And we're doing a public hearing on your appointment to the Quality Education Commission and just calling to talk to you about why you want to serve on the commission and what you think you bring to this position, this role.
Okay. I want to be on the commission, first of all, because I've already been serving, and I feel like I have already contributed and have more to contribute. The role I was in before was principal, and I was representing Central Oregon. Now I'm in Eugene Forte, and I'm in a directorship. And my number one passion is to help raise student achievement, and especially for students in the gap. And ever since the whole standards movement, I've been involved in work with the State Department over designing assessments and scoring assessments and giving feedback around the changes around standards we've implemented. And then as I worked in three districts in Central Oregon, bringing that perspective of the rural school districts and now to a bigger city school district, my strength is instructional leadership. And because I've served as a principal, assistant principal, teacher, and now a director, I think I bring a wide range of perspective as a practitioner. And I feel like when issues come up and we have questions about what does this really look like at the school level, or how could this be implemented, I know even when we had conversations about efficiencies and how we could provide efficiencies in school. Not only did I have information about that, but when I learned more from those on the commission, I actually went back in my school and implemented some of the suggestions to gather data for the commission about how that would work. And I'd be willing to do that within our whole school district here in Eugene for a day.
All right, thank you. And what do you see the role of the Quality Education Commission?
I see that the role continues to evolve. In the very beginning, I think the idea was to help clarify and identify what is needed to create a high-quality educational system. I know the focus has changed somewhat to educating people about why we need more stable funding and how that would be used and where those efficiencies are. And I think that we need to continue to do that, both helping the policy decision makers understand and be providing them with all the resources and information they need. But I think at the same time, we have a responsibility to the community to hear the community and hear what they want, and then also to provide the new information we're getting with the community. So I see that that role will continue to evolve. I know we're starting to come just a little bit out of our economic slump. I don't know if that's really been felt yet at the schools because we continue to make cuts. But I think that we need to have the conversation continue to be around stable funding, but also around what are the elements needed for a quality education, and is that always a monetary conversation? administration. I don't believe it always is. And I think we have to continue to hold ourselves accountable to making sure that we're using things the most efficient way possible and that we're using evidence-based practices and those kinds of things.
Do you think the commission has been or should be a tool for the legislature in solving the school funding crises?
Yes, I do.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Senator Shields, Senator Lingo? Okay. So no further questions. We very much appreciate your willingness to testify via phone this morning. We're setting a new process in the Rules Committee and only doing public hearings and let the appointments sit for a week or so, and then we'll come back in work session. Governor's office will inform you as the status. All right?
Okay. Thank you so much, and thanks for your willingness to do this on the telephone.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Take care.
Bye now.
Close the public hearing on Quality Education Commission. I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 858 and have the committee administrator tell us. I know we have a number of amendments, and hopefully Ted E. will get this throughout the building and come dashing back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard this bill previously on March 10th. Essentially, the bill just requires a space in the voters' pamphlets designated for candidate statements to include a disclaimer that says, in essence, that the material submitted by the candidates has not been verified for truth or accuracy by the state of Oregon. We discussed some different ideas about the precise language of the disclaimer at our last meeting on the 10th, and we have some amendments coming which I think reflect sort of a compromise position about the various ideas that were raised on the 10th when we looked at the precise language of the disclaimer.
Okay. And the dash four amendments are from the Secretary of State's office, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Anybody from the Secretary of State's office wishing to come forward to talk about the amendments?
I thought I saw Fred Neal here. But
there he is. Speaking of Mr. Neal, why don't you come on forward?
You're right on time.
Quite amazing. Would you just walk us through the dash four amendments and let us know what you're trying to... Do you need a copy of them?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've not seen them yet.
Okay. Oh, okay. It's my understanding that the dash four amendments provide a disclaimer. Mr. E., I can't remember your last name, but why don't you come on forward? That the provide for the disclaimer that the above information has not been verified for accuracy by the state of Oregon. And then on the page two of the amendment, the amendments shorten the length of the voter's pamphlet statement by, is on my recollection, 25 words. Is that correct?
Yes, correct. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Fred Neal, voter's pamphlet supervisor, campaign finance manager for the Elections Division, Secretary of State's office. That is what the dash four amendments do, and they apply the disclaimer requirement and the word count limitation to county voters' pamphlets as well.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Teddy Kaiser from Senator Joanne Berger's office, representing the Senate District 5, Coastal District, and I must apologize. I'm beginning stages of laryngitis, so my voice isn't this.
I think Senator Ringo is suffering from the same affliction.
Yeah, we'll try to spread it around.
There's, as just passed around, there's also a dash three amendments. This does the same as the dash four, except it does not reduce the number of words. And this is the version that our office is most in support of.
Okay. Comments from the committee? The chair would like to move the dash three amendments and let Mr. Neal make his case to the House committee. I'm concerned about reducing the number of words that each candidate has in the voter's pamphlet statement, but I'm certainly willing to have Mr. Neal take his case to the House. I also understand that it might be a very practical issue with the voter's pamphlet itself and that they may have to get it all in. Anyway, Senator Shields, any comments?
Fred Neal, do you actually think it's going to push each page, half page, over onto the other half and make things longer? Can you physically do it? What's the deal?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, we'll simply reduce the white space in the 30 square inches that we have to get the candidates' words and this information provided by the picture, the office sought, the name of the candidate, the party affiliation, et cetera, in to that 30 square inches. We'll just reduce white space wherever possible.
Follow up.
Senator Shields.
So the dash three is just mean that actually we could improve the voter's pamphlet by making all our pictures smaller. Is that correct? that would be my option, you know, make our pictures smaller, put in the disclaimer.
I'm not going to have Mr. Neal respond to that question.
I'm sure we'll be open to all suggestions for this measure.
Well, but my point is, if you were seriously constrained for space, 30 inches, you have options under the ballot, under the dash 3 amendments that wouldn't make the pamphlet any longer.
Correct.
Okay. And I'm not suggesting that you make our pictures smaller. You can cut them all off about here, maybe. Who knows?
Senator Shields, some of us think that for some candidates it's probably better that the picture be bigger and that the words be less, but, you know, far be it for me.
Well, those that are pretty operate differently than the rest of them.
Yeah. Okay, we are in work session. The chair would move the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 858. Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing none, motion passes. Chair would move Senate Bill 858 as amended to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Right on.
Any objection? Hearing and seeing none. And we'd ask Senator Verger to carry this bill on the Senate floor. Seeing as there's no further business to come before the committee, Senator Ringo, you would like to have your bill introduction.
Can I do it?
Great.
Yes, please.
We're going to do that. Okay.
Just bringing us a concept. Okay. You might need to take a 2 minutes.
All right. We've got a couple of concepts coming. Everyone should be informed that the chair is pretty much going to shut down drafting measures probably next week, that you all should be looking for
your committee staff supports you.
My committee staff supports me. You should be looking for relating clauses, but since the Senate is going to stop hearing Senate bills on April 8th, we're basically running out of time. Senator Ringo, what do we have in front of us?
Well, given several events of the last day, I think it's prudent to at least get in the process a bill that might address broader annexation issues, rather than run two bills out of the Senate, maybe one bill out of the Senate, and we need to go with a broader relating clause.
Okay. And so you're asking legislative council draft language, including Senate bills 887 with the dash 3 and Senate bills 699 with the dash 1.
That's correct.
And you're asking for that to be all in one bill. Is that correct?
Yes, and I would like the motion to be, Madam Chair, that this committee authorize the drafting of this bill and its introduction.
Okay. Senator Ringo has moved that we authorize the drafting and introduction of the combined Senate Bill 887 and 669 with the dash 3 and the dash 1 amendments.
And
Senator Shields.
And the third point on there.
Right. I don't really want that much detail in the motion. Will we find that in the legislative council?
Madam Chair,
Senator Ringo.
I assume that, I mean, actually, I think, just in thinking, I would prefer the dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 887. There's enough flexibility in the process so that
Are you being serious?
I am being serious, because
okay.
The dash 4 amendments include Senator Deckert's mediation.
How about if we authorize the Senate Rules Committee, how the motion is going to be to authorize the legislative council to draft a new bill relating to annexation?
That's beautiful.
Okay. Senator Ringo has moved that we authorize legislative council to draft and a bill relating to annexation and that it would be introduced as a rules committee when it's completed. Is there any discussion? Senator Shields.
I like the broad way you've said it. I do want to affirm on the record that I like Senator Ringo's reference to Dash 4 because it's a very good piece of work that was done by Senator Deckert.
Great.
Yesterday.
Well, we I'll let Sam Marengo deal with legislative council on that. He now, assuming that motion passes, he has the ability to go get the bill drafted the way he and Senator Jack would like. So, any further discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, motion passes. We have just given the authority of legislative council to draft a new bill and to be introduced by the Rules Committee relating to annexation. We're going to be in recess for a couple minutes while we wait for another concept.
Sorry. It's okay.
Thank you.
You can't go anywhere.
March 31st, the chair would move that we introduce the concurrent resolution on Nick Robertson as a committee bill. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the motion passes. Is there any further business to come before the committee? Hearing and seeing none, we are officially adjourned.
Okay.
Charlie. Yes.